Good evening, everyone. I'm Lynor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation just released its 2018 Goalkeepers Report. It is an initiative launched in 2017 to track progress on the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs, a collection of 17 global goals set by the United Nations Development Programme to be attained by the year 2030. According to the United Nations, the SDGs are a universal call to action to end poverty, protect the planet, and ensure that all people enjoy peace and prosperity, among other things. I spoke to Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and asked her why it was important to publish such a report. Melinda Gates, welcome to the Voice of America. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation released a report. It is the Bill and Melinda Gates 2018 Goalkeepers Report. It has just been released, and it's an initiative launched in 2017 to track progress on the Sustainable Development Goals. Why was it important to publish such a report?
Well, these goals that were set by the member nations of the United Nations really are a roadmap and a blueprint for the world on if we make these investments, we can really make progress as a world. But we felt it was important to publish a report every year so that we hold ourselves accountable as a world to these goals, and we can actually measure year by year, is the world making progress?
So then, what is the value added of the report as the global community aims to achieve the SDGs? Is it to measure essentially how we're making progress?
Yes, the report helps us show, are we making progress? And it also shines light on countries that have made certain investments, like Brazil on nutrition or Vietnam on education, to say, these are exemplars for the world. They've made incredible progress by the very specific investments they've made. And these are roadmaps for other countries to then follow.
Now, this is the second publication of the report. What did you find significant this year? What were some of the significant findings?
Well, one of the biggest findings that we wanted to highlight that I think we felt many people didn't know was how young the population is in Africa. 60% of the population is under the age of 25. And so if the world makes the right investments in health and nutrition and education, this is an amazing generation that has unbelievable ingenuity. And if we make those investments, we give them leadership opportunities to lift their societies and their countries up. And we want to make sure that message gets out to the world. Let's make these investments so that they can change their whole country.
So then clearly investment is very critical in terms of carrying this young population in the future for economic growth. What are your thoughts on the importance of young people in Africa's development as we look to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals?
Well, the young people often have the new ideas, they have vibrancy, they're energetic, they see things in a different way. And if we make sure that we give those leaders opportunities, they will seize them and they will make sure that things change in their countries. Some perfect examples are some of the young women I'm meeting in the health sector. They're saying, we're realizing that if we give access to contraceptives to young women, that is women who come in who are 16, 17, 18 years old, and we're not biased about how we treat them, oh my gosh, they can space the births of their children and attend school and stay in university. We know that those investments in contraceptives, that when women have access around the world, it lifts up their whole family and it lifts up whole economies. And so I'm inspired by these young leaders who say, I'm going to work on taking bias out of the healthcare system. That's just one example of many.
And you mentioned contraceptive. It's definitely part of the big picture as we look at family planning. Why is it a key aspect of development?
Because if you look at all the economies who've made the transition from low to middle to high income countries, every one of them allowed voluntary access to contraceptives to women. Because we know if men and women can space the births of their children and have them if and when they want to have them, there are more opportunities then for those children and for their families. Girls can stay in school, they can get their daughters educated, they can feed their children. Once they're fed, well-fed, nourished, educated, those people create amazing opportunities and new jobs in the economy. But you can't make that economic transition without, that is one of the pillars that you have to put in place, is voluntary access to contraceptives. It's not the only, but it's one of the key levers.
What key steps are encouraged when discussing family planning to adolescent girls of reproductive age versus women? What are some of the strategies?
Well, first you have to teach a young woman about her body, right? About how her reproductive organs work, her sexuality, and then you have to tell her about methods that might work for her as a young teenage girl. We know that over the course of a woman's life, what she chooses will be different at different times based on what her needs are. You also have to take away a lot of myths that they've heard and to counsel them about side effects and where to go if they're having problems. All of those are important steps, but they're all completely possible. We've seen them country after country. And literally, if you start educating women and you give them access to contraceptives, it only takes one generation till they take them up.
Your travel to Kenya earlier this year, would you please share with us that experience in terms of talking to young women and girls and addressing their needs?
Well, I've talked to young women and girls all over Africa for many years. And then I would say in Kenya, one of the most exciting things I saw this year were actually, to be honest, the governors, the young leaders who are in power now in Kenya. Those governors are interested in making the right investments in their states in Kenya, and that includes investments in nutrition, investments in doing the right things in clinics and in immunizations. But one of the most exciting things that they told me is how interested they are in contraceptives for young girls and making sure they have access. That was something I'd never heard from the leadership in Kenya before. Then when I also met with President Kenyatta, one of his four pillars that he's putting in place is making sure that people have great access to healthcare. So when you see a government that is making investments in health and making the right investments, that's the kind of leadership we want to see all over the world. And those are some of the kinds of things that we highlight in this Goalkeepers report.
You are definitely a firm believer in empowering women and girls, and we've been following your work over the years. When you look at where we are, I know we just talked about access to contraceptive and family planning. What do you see as some of other priority areas in developing countries, especially African countries, as the world looks to achieving the SDGs in 2030?
Sure. In countries, the investments that need to be made are in health, and in education, and in the agricultural sector. If you make investments in all three of those areas, so in health, making sure that the number of childhood deaths go down by vaccinating children, making sure people have access to malaria bed net, making sure they have access to contraceptives, good nutrition and counseling around nutrition. In education, we've made as a world a commitment in the previous set of goals to make sure kids had access to school, which they now do. So enrollment's there, but we need to get the quality of education to come up, much like Vietnam has done, as we highlight in the report. And then in the agriculture sector, we need to make sure that we help countries move from subsistence farming to making real investments so that you can do larger scale farming so they can feed themselves. And again, we give a great example of that from Ghana in the report.
Now, let's look at poverty. I mean, we've been talking about this to some extent. Since 2000, more than 1 billion people have lifted themselves out of extreme poverty, which is a great achievement, and this is mentioned in the report. However, the report also says that decades of stunning progress in the fight against poverty and disease may be on the verge of stalling. To what do you attribute this challenge?
Well, we wanted to highlight what we're seeing. So, as you said, this incredible reduction in poverty, incredible. But what we don't want the world to assume is that it's inevitable. It is because of investments the world made systematically in human capital, in health, in education, in agriculture. When those systematic investments are made, you see this enormous reduction in poverty, and life gets better. It improves for people around the world. But conversely, if you don't make those investments, if you don't continue to make those investments, a lot of the gains that we've seen can drop back, particularly with a growing population. And so our message to the world is keep your foot on the gas, keep the accelerator going. We need to keep making these investments. Both we need high-income countries to make the continued investments in things like the Global Fund, and we need low- and middle-income countries to keep making the investments in their own country, and then measure it with great data, because that's how we learn.
You talked about investment. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has invested more than $15 billion in projects relevant to Africa. Why is Africa such an important part of your work?
We fundamentally believe as a foundation, and Bill and I, that all lives have equal value, no matter where they're lived on the planet. Yet when you see some of the people who are in extreme poverty or extreme situation where many, many infants are dying or mothers are dying in childbirth, you see a lot of that predominantly in countries in Africa and a couple of states in northern India. And so we call out Africa and we make substantial investments in Africa because we think life can improve there in the ways that it has in other places in the world, like South Korea, that used to be a low-income country that no longer is. The other thing I want to say about our investments, while they look extremely large, $15 billion is a large number. When you look at what we're trying to tackle as a foundation, it takes immense partnership around the world. Many, many, many partners doing the work on the ground in culturally, contextually sensitized ways, and governments scaling these projects up so that everyone can have those benefits. So our foundation is what we call a catalytic wedge. We start getting those things going. We show points of light, waves of making change. We take some risks, but ultimately it's the governments who scale them up. And that work is done in deep partnership with many people around the globe.
And what should we look forward to in terms of future investment or priorities?
Well, I think for us as a foundation, we will always be focused on the things we're focused on now. That is health, agriculture, and we're doing a bit of international education, quality international education around the world. What I think you can see for us, though, while we've always had a science and technology focus, because Bill and I believe fundamentally innovations that change the world, you've seen us move more towards how do we deliver those great advances in the last few years. We've gotten much more focused on delivery. And I think you're now also seeing us talking a lot more about women's empowerment, because if we want to get enormous gains in the world, we need to pull all three levels, the science and technology, get it delivered, and then we've got to get it in the hands of women, because women so often are at the center of the family and are the ones who are making those investments in their family. And so you'll see us doing even more on women's empowerment, because that will lift up the whole world.
And Melinda Gates, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Lenore.
And that was Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Well, it's now time to take a short break. And when we come back, we will have a live discussion on safe surgeries, which is very critical in healthcare delivery. But first, a quick roundup of the latest health news with Camilla Tam.
The latest child mortality report released today shows the steady reduction in child mortality in Nigeria continued in 2017. According to the new mortality estimates released by UNICEF, the World Health Organization, the United Nations Population Division, and the World Bank Group, under 5 mortality rate in Nigeria reduced from 103.8 in 2016 to 100.2 deaths per 1,000 live births. Furthermore, neonatal mortality rates fell from 33.5 to 32.9. Neonatal mortality rate refers to the probability of dying between birth and 28 days of age, expressed per 1,000 live births. The latest levels and trends in child mortality report 2018 from UNICEF and partners in the UN Interagency Group for Child Mortality Estimation shows the full scope of child and mortality rates across the world, from newborns to adolescents. Botswana leaders made a call for urgent action on non-communicable diseases, or NCDs, in the African region Monday at a landmark forum held in Gaborone. The call comes as the world prepares for a high-level meeting on NCDs at the UN General Assembly in New York, which will take place at the end of September 2018. NCDs are a group of chronic health conditions that include cardiovascular diseases, cancers, mental disorders, and diabetes. They are now the leading killers on the planet, causing 7 in 10 deaths globally. The major causes are avoidable risk factors like tobacco use, harmful alcohol consumption, physical inactivity, and unhealthy diets. In Africa, countries are seeing a rapid rise in NCD cases. Zimbabwe is struggling with this deadliest outbreak of cholera in a decade, which has killed at least 28 people. An emergency has been declared and public gatherings banned in the capital, Harare. An outbreak of the waterborne disease was confirmed by authorities in early September, killing 5 people and infecting dozens more. Within weeks, the death toll had risen to 28 with more than 5,000 reported cases of infection. The World Health Organization and the Red Cross are ramping up their emergency response. National and local politicians are trading blame over a failure to maintain safe water supplies and maintain infrastructure. And that's a wrap-up of the latest news.
Welcome back. For those of you joining us late tonight, we will be talking now in the second half of the program. We will turn to surgery. Every year, millions of people undergo surgical treatment. And while surgical procedures are intended to save lives, unsafe surgical care can cause substantial harm. The World Health Organization says complications after inpatient operations occur in up to 25% of patients, and mortality from general anesthesia alone is reported to be as high as 1 in 150 in some part of sub-Saharan Africa. Well, to discuss this, we are joined via phone from Baltimore, Maryland, by Dr. John Varallo. He is a global surgery director with JPIGO, a global health nonprofit organization. Dr. Varallo, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lori. Thank you for having us on your show.
Fantastic. We are also joined by Dr. Augustino Helar, director of the Safe Surgery Program with JPIGO Tanzania. Dr. Helar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So the both of you are together joining us from Baltimore. And listen, safe surgery is a topic that is so critical. However, there seems that not to have enough coverage, to my experience. So let me start with you, Dr. Varallo. Would you describe for us the global burden of surgical care? To what extent is it a problem?
Yeah, and it is a very important issue. And to start, when we talk about surgical care, we need to acknowledge that it's an absolutely essential component of healthcare. And as you're alluding to, I think it's that importance tends to be underestimated, even within the global health community. To put that in perspective, you know, globally, 5 billion people. 5 billion people lack access to safe surgical care. And if we look at, you know, for comparing it to other health conditions, for example, more lives are lost from treatable surgical conditions than from HIV, malaria, and TB combined. In fact, there's 18 million lives are lost due to lack of access to safe surgical care. That's 5 times more than HIV, malaria, and TB combined. And when we start looking at this, what, you know, underlying these numbers are also equity gaps. If we look at, you know, globally, that the burden of this lack of access falls more heavily on certain countries, such as in the sub-Saharan Africa, Southeast Asia, and parts of Latin America and Caribbean. And you see this inequity even within countries. And you're looking at certain populations that really lack access to it, such as rural versus urban populations, and that really drives that inequity.
That's incredible. That's really, to think about it, it's incredible to know that so many people die of it, but. You know, we don't talk much about it. Listen, Dr. Heller, let me ask you this. Dr. Varallo mentioned 5 billion people lack access to safe surgical care. How does this translate in Tanzania? Describe for us the situation in Tanzania.
Yeah, so the situation in Tanzania is just like what Dr. Varallo just mentioned. So In the regions where we work, we have very few specialists who are providing surgical care. So we work in two regions in Tanzania called Kagera and Mara in the Lake Zone of Tanzania. And in these regions, we have only one surgical specialist for a population of about 3 million people, and then also about three OBGYNs for a for the same population, and no anesthesiologists. So simply there are no enough specialists to provide services. And the number of the number one procedure that is being done in these facilities is cesarean section. The, what we are doing now is to train non-specialists to be able to provide skilled, safe surgical care for the populations in these areas.
Wow, that's incredible. Dr. Varalo, when you heard this statistic in Tanzania, one specialist for so many people, would you say that the fundamental issue here is lack of specialists, lack of expertise when it comes to low and middle income country or countries, or does it depend on each country or each region?
Well, you know, I do think it depends on the different contexts, but we do know that the lack of the workforce, lack of skills in our workforce is an issue, but it doesn't mean that it has to be a specialist. And so that's what we're focusing on in Tanzania and also many of our countries, is building the skills of these non-specialists. And if these non-specialist teams we build their skills and their knowledge to the point where they're competent and confident and able to provide these services, then you're building that access. The other issue also is it's not just around human resources, but ensuring that the facility, the infrastructure is there, the equipment, the supplies, the oxygen, water, and the blood. So all those things kind of go hand in hand.
So, Dr. Heller, you mentioned that in one of these areas there is no anesthesiologist. So how do you handle a situation like this?
Yeah, so we are building the capacity of these teams to be able to provide safe surgical services, first by training them. We're training them on leadership skills that help them to identify some challenges that they face on their day-to-day basis, then put up action plans to solve some of these challenges. But we're also pairing them to mentors from a local referral zone or hospital, and these mentors can help them work with them to solve their challenges, but also work with them to do surgical procedures, meaning that it will build their confidence in providing safe surgery and with less complications.
Okay. Now, Dr. Heller mentioned earlier that many of the patients who need surgery, well, the number one surgery that is being provided is cesarean section. So how are women being affected by this very little access to safe surgery?
Yeah, and that's a great point, because you know when we're talking about those numbers, we also see that there's a gender gap as well. And if we look at globally, timely access to safe cesarean section can prevent nearly 100,000 maternal deaths each year and reduce newborn deaths by 30% to 70%. And so JAPAIGO's approach is that beyond just providing the routine maternal and newborn health services, we want to make sure that we're also including this surgical component, because without that, then you're not really going to have as much of an impact on improving maternal and newborn health.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Heller, in Tanzania then, what are the steps? I know you talked about capacity building. This is also a problem of the healthcare system as a whole. So what is being done in that regard?
Yeah, so at the national level, we are supporting the government of Tanzania to develop a national, we have supported them to develop a national surgical obstetric and anesthesia plan that is like a roadmap for strengthening surgical services, obstetric services and anesthesia services in the country in general. But then we are also working at the facility level in these two regions where, as I said, we train surgical teams to empower them to be able to solve their challenges. But we're also giving them clinical skills and infection prevention skills so that the surgeries they do have less complications and they can provide more access to surgery to the communities around them.
Okay. Now, Dr. Varalo, access to safe surgery, access to surgery in general is not just a problem in the developing world. In the developed world, some people will argue that the cost of surgery is a problem. So if it is a problem in countries where people have the means to have surgeries, what about in the developing world, in a place like Tanzania or other countries? What is your take on the cost of surgeries?
Yeah, and that's another great point. And when we talk about access, we can talk about whether it's, you know, just the physical location, so distance to a facility, having the qualified provider and the infrastructure, as we mentioned, but also the cost. And so that can be a real barrier, especially if you're talking about where the access is only in the private sector. So that's why we really have this push for the universal health coverage, because, you know, if it's so costly that it can that it prevents that access, then the choice for the family is to decide whether either to forego the services or to go into extreme debt. So that is a really top priority for us, is to guarantee that universal health coverage so that people don't need to make that decision and that they aren't. Go in debt, go into poverty just by having this basic service.
Okay. And quickly before we wrap, Dr. Varalo, how would you make the case for safe surgery? I mean, when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals and all the issues that are on the agenda, and even in general, when we want to advance global health, safe surgeries, again, as I mentioned earlier, doesn't seem to get much attention. How do we make a case?
Well, we make the case by pointing out the importance of surgical care, that it's not a luxury, that it is an absolutely essential and indivisible component of health care, and that by making the investment, if you look at the investment needed for safe surgery, that you have a return on that investment. And so it's actually a wise investment for countries. And so we can look at it from that standpoint as well as a human rights standpoint. So I think that's where we need to really kind of drive the message.
And Dr. Heller, the final was to you. Tell us about perhaps some positive outcome you've seen since you've been working on this.
Yeah, so we started to implement this program earlier this year, and already we are seeing early results. The surgical teams that we are training have more teamwork and communication. They've developed action plans to solve many of the challenges they face, like they want to increase surgical volumes in their facilities, they want to reduce complication rates, they want to reduce waiting times for patients, but they all are also using the WHO Surgical Safety Checklist, which is a simple tool to enhance safety.
Okay.
Improve communication within the surgical teams.
All right, gentlemen, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Dr. Augustino Heller and Dr. John Varalo, for joining us today.
Thank you.
And we also thank Melinda Gates, a co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for talking to Health Chat today. Thanks to all of you for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliates for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Mudu in Washington, with producer Bonsa Tufa, Camila Tom with the news, and engineer Alfredo. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.
This is VOA News. I'm